From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Today, in Minneapolis, the city's chief of police, Madaria Arredondo, took the stand in the trial against one of his former officers. Derek Chauvin is accused of murdering George Floyd in May.
Up until May 26, 2020, an individual named Derek Chauvin was a Minneapolis police officer. Is that right?
That is correct.
And are you aware of who this person is?
I am.
Do you recognize this person in the courtroom today?
I do.
NPR national correspondent Layla Fadel is in Minneapolis, where she's been covering this trial. Layla, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is a big moment to have the chief of police on the stand. What else are we hearing from him today?
Right. It is a big moment and quite rare for high-level officers to testify against one of its own, let alone the police chief. That's pretty much unprecedented. But, you know, Chief Arredondo has been really vocal about this case since the beginning. He fired Chauvin and the four other officers the day after Floyd's death. And he also spoke to the Floyd family. He went to the scene of where Floyd was killed. And at that time, he said in an interview that this was a violation of humanity. He also issued a statement calling this murder and not a lack of training. And so those are the things that we expect him to expand on today on the stand.
Well, last week's testimony was very emotional. It included accounts from bystanders, George Floyd's girlfriend, paramedics who came to the scene, and also on Friday, Lieutenant Richard Zimmerman, who's the longest-serving officer on the Minneapolis police force. He testified for the prosecution and said that Chauvin's use of force on Floyd was totally unnecessary. Let's listen.
Pulling him down to the ground, face down, and putting your knee on the neck for that amount of time is just uncalled for.
We also heard testimony last week from Sergeant David Pluger, who was Chauvin's supervisor. He's since retired. We mentioned the chief of police is on the stand today. Again, how unusual is it for this many members of law enforcement to be testifying against one of their own?
Yeah, I mean, extremely unusual. This is not something we typically see in cases of excessive use of force or killings that police are accused of. But in this case, it seems that the department has decided that they will be testifying in this case with Derek Chauvin as the prosecution builds its case that it is not anything but the force that we saw in that video that killed Chauvin. And as the defense tries to poke holes in that and raise reasonable doubt, saying it actually wasn't that knee on the neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds that ultimately led to Floyd's death.
Also today we heard from the doctor who provided emergency care to Floyd at the hospital and was the one who actually pronounced him dead. Did we learn anything more from that testimony?
Well, he said that Floyd likely died due to a lack of oxygen. He said that paramedics tried for 30 minutes to revive Floyd prior to his arrival at the emergency room, and that it was about an hour after Floyd's heart stopped that he pronounced him dead. And again, both the prosecution and the defense are trying to establish what actually caused Floyd's death. And in the prosecution's case, they're trying to show that it was what was seen on that video, the knee on the neck, officers also holding him down, two other officers, and the defense trying to say it might have been something else, drugs, an enlarged heart. And we saw that on display in the questioning of this doctor today.
Well, as we said, last week was very emotional. I wonder if you can give us a sense of what the rest of this week will look like, and do you know when the defense will begin to call its witnesses?
Well, at this point, we're looking at more testimony about issues around use of force in the department, so police officers being called to the stand, the police chief on the stand right now, and also the medical case. What actually killed George Floyd? Was it that knee on the neck, or, as the defense is trying to establish, was it something else? And then at the end of the prosecution's case is something called Spark of Life, where they'll present who George Floyd was, what made him who he was beyond just his name and his body. So what made George Floyd a person, you know, beyond that? And that's allowed here in Minnesota for a murder trial for victims of alleged murder. And then the defense begins its case and building its case, and we expect that possibly next week.
All right. NPR national correspondent Layla Fadel in Minneapolis. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
A political crisis is unfolding in Jordan. The country's deputy prime minister has accused a former crown prince, his half-brother, of plotting against the government. Hamza bin Hussein says he's been under house arrest and has denied orchestrating a conspiracy. In a video released to the BBC, he said he would not escalate the situation, but also vowed to defy his house arrest orders.
This country has become stymied in corruption, in nepotism, and in misrule. And the result has been the destruction or the loss of hope that is apparent in pretty much every Jordanian.
The BBC's Lise Doucette has been following the story, and she joins us now by Skype. Hello, Lise.
Hello.
16 people were arrested on Saturday in this alleged plot. What is the Jordanian state saying about what happened here?
What an extraordinary story in the country that's been widely regarded as this rare island of stability in the volatile region, living right next door to Iraq, to Syria, Saudi Arabia, the West Bank. When the news first broke on Saturday evening, it sent a bolt of electricity across Jordan and beyond. Yesterday, the government, through its deputy prime minister, Ayman Safadi, spoke of the intelligence agencies monitoring both Prince Hamza as well as other prominent individuals for months, that there had been communications with foreign entities, all designed to destabilize the kingdom. And in very dramatic language, he talked about zero hour that the security sweep happened just when this design of a plot was going to go into action.
So the former crown prince Hamza bin Hussein is King Abdullah's half-brother, right? He has a different version of what has happened here. He spoke to the BBC. Tell us what he's saying.
Prince Hamza released a video in which he said that he'd been visited by the chief of general staff, that he'd been told to cut off his communications, to remain at home, because he said he had been in meetings where there'd been criticism of the king or the government. But he said he did not make those criticisms. He wasn't part of any conspiracy, but he did go on to criticize the corruption, the misrule, the nepotism. He said that was not his doing. He even talked about how he wanted to be seen as a caring member of the royal family. And that, too, is a direct challenge to his half-brother, the king.
So how did we get to this point, Lise? I mean, you call Jordan the island of stability in a difficult region. How long has this turmoil been developing there?
Well, I've been going to Jordan for a very long time. And whenever I'm there, there's always been, in sitting rooms, in open spaces, hushed conversations about corruption and misrule, but it never came out much in the public. First of all, there are strict media laws in Jordan against slandering the king or the royal family. Now, Prince Hamza has been known in the past to express this kind of criticism, and now it seems he's been meeting people and talking about that, and so that has no doubt rung alarm bells among Jordan's all-powerful intelligence services, and that has got to the king himself.
Officials in the United States and in the UK have voiced support for Jordan's King Abdullah, as have regional powers in Egypt and Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Put this all into context for us, Lise. Why does this palace intrigue in Jordan have the attention of so many around the world leaders?
It's extraordinary. I've never seen an event where the series of reactions were so quick and so uniform. They all talked about, and these are neighbors, including other Arab monarchies, allies like the United States further away, expressing full support to King Abdullah. And King Abdullah, who does what he can do, his kingdom being a country so resource poor, he said to look to his neighbors and friends to hold him up.
So, Lise, what does this mean geopolitically for the region? Talk about that ripple effect here.
Well, when you have this small anchor of stability, a small quiet corner, if that goes, then you've got a whole stretch of even bigger stretch of territory where there is no last redoubts, if you like. You know, people look to Jordan for a mediating role, a humanitarian role. It would have an effect across the region. Now, we're not talking about this now. Right now, this is an unprecedented royal rift in the family. We have to wait and see how King Abdullah will respond to this crisis. But with this second audio recording that's been released by Prince Hamza, in which he says he doesn't want to escalate things, but he's definitely not going to obey orders, that is open defiance of a kind that you have never seen in Jordan before.
That's the BBC's Lise Doucette. Lise, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Another battle is brewing on Capitol Hill. President Biden hopes to push through a historically diverse slate of federal judges. He's trying to make a mark on a judiciary that President Trump transformed during his tenure. There are dozens of vacancies, and Biden is hoping to fill them before next year's midterms while Democrats still control the Senate. For more, we're joined now by NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, tell us a little bit about Biden's judicial nominations and how they compare with Trump's nominees.
Well, they are very different from Trump's nominations. First of all, they are incredibly diverse. Trump's were largely white and predominantly male. Most of the nominations that Biden made last week are minorities and women. I think 8 or 9 of them are women. And they're extremely diverse racially and ethnically, and they're extremely diverse in their professional backgrounds. You know, if you look at the backgrounds of most federal court judges, not exclusively, but mainly, they came to it by being prosecutors, by being corporate lawyers, and sometimes by being defense lawyers. But this group has a significant number of public defenders, that is, people who have represented indigent defendants. And definitely they sometimes worked for private law firms later or earlier in their lives, and some of them have been both defense lawyers and prosecutors. But they are very different in the kinds of backgrounds they have in civil rights, in public interest. They are not predominantly corporate lawyers. So in that way, they're very different. And there are a couple of standouts, especially, I would say, the nominee to replace now Attorney General Merrick Garland, Ketanji Brown Jackson, who has been a district court judge, I think, for about 7 or 8 years. She is African-American. She was a public defender. She also worked for a private law firm. She did a lot of appellate work and litigation, and she was vice chairman of the Sentencing Commission, the U.S. Sentencing Commission, at a time when they were trying to reduce the crack cocaine penalties. So I've given you sort of an overview.
Yes. Well, I'm curious. President Trump managed to confirm nearly as many judges as President Obama did in half the time. It was one of Mitch McConnell's priorities when he was majority leader. I'm curious what you think Democrats have learned from his tactics as they face these nominations.
Well, you know, President Biden was for 16 years either the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee or the ranking member. So it certainly did not go unnoticed by him that the Obama administration was late getting off the dime in making judicial appointments, and it did not go unnoticed that Mitch McConnell can be a real thorn in the side of a Democratic president when it comes to confirming his nominees. So I think that this administration has likely learned that lesson. And yet, they also have legislative priorities, and these nominees and more to follow, I assume, because there are close to 100 vacancies. They will have to get them through at the same time that they're trying to pass legislation. In other words, they're going to have to walk and chew gum at the same time.
And so Democrats are rushing then to confirm these nominations. Who knows if they will keep the Senate in 2022? A lot of Republicans wondering, how can we slow them down? What can they do?
Well, they actually can't do a lot. It's true that Mitch McConnell is a master at slow-walking nominations, but what he did when Trump was president was he got rid of all of the little things that most people don't know about, or most of them, that allow the minority party to slow down the process. So if the Democrats really get their bottoms in gear, they could get this done, but they're going to have to really work at it.
Well, Justin Stephen Breyer is the oldest member of the Supreme Court. Some liberals are pressuring him to step down right now. Nina Totenberg, do you think that that's Biden's best hope at filling a seat?
It's most likely. He's 82 years old. We have no idea whether he's going to do that or not. If he's going to do it, it would be best, I think people would, and probably have told him, to let the White House know before the end of the term so that they can start making the process of a nomination for a replacement. And Ketanji Brown Jackson is probably one of the several names that are most prominently mentioned. But, you know, the minute you get close to an election year, it gets harder and harder to keep the Senate in session. And so this is a balancing act for everybody.
Well, speaking of the Supreme Court, they released some important decisions today, including one where they ruled in favor of Google. Tell us about the significance of this one, Nina.
By a 6-2 vote, with Justice Breyer writing the decision, the court declared that Google did not infringe on Oracle's copyright when it used some of Oracle's computer code lines to create a new software system for smartphones in the early 2000s. Google used just 11,500 lines of the Java code, which was created by Oracle. But as the Supreme Court noted today, that was only 0.4% of the Java code. And because Google incorporated that 0.4% in an entirely new and transformative code for Android smartphones, the court said that was a fair use under the nation's copyright laws. And so this is a huge, huge win for Google and also for open platforms, because Oracle wanted to charge for using its code, and Google does not do that.
That is NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Indian state of Maharashtra is imposing a curfew and weekend lockdowns as coronavirus cases surge. Yesterday, India recorded nearly 104,000 new infections, a new one-day record. The BBC's Rajini Vidyanathan is with us now from Delhi. Hi, Rajini.
Nice to talk to you, Hita.
And how bad is this latest surge in India? What's happening?
It's really serious. Officials say things have gone from bad to worse here in India. And just to give you some context, at the start of this year, cases fell dramatically. And I think a lot of people here in India felt that the worst was over. People were going about their lives, lots of big gatherings, events. And certainly people I spoke to felt that, you know, the worst had gone last summer and even last autumn. And the case numbers seem to reflect that. But now what we're seeing in the last couple of weeks is a very sharp increase in the number of reported cases and also in the daily death rate as well, or the daily number of deaths, I should say. And that has been a real cause for concern. Now, more than half of the reported cases in the last 24-hour period came from the western state of Maharashtra. That is where, as of Monday, they're bringing in some restrictions. It's not really a full lockdown, but it's some restrictions to try and contain the rising cases.
So what do you think is going on here? Because, you know, you're right. A couple of weeks ago, I remember speaking with one of your colleagues at the BBC, and the infections had gotten so low that there was some speculation that maybe some communities within India had reached herd immunity. So why do you think this surge is happening now?
Well, firstly, I think the idea of herd immunity was something that people threw around here, but talking to epidemiologists, that was never what they felt. One of the reasons why overall India's had a relatively low death rate is it's got a younger population. And so a lot of epidemiologists who I've talked to said that's a big factor in why the death rate's been a lot lower, because as we've seen in other parts of the world, it's the elder population that seems to get coronavirus a lot more seriously. But in answer to your question, I mean, government officials say that lax behaviour is to blame for the rise in cases. But a number of doctors at some of the leading hospitals, they also believe that the new strains of coronavirus that we've seen in recent months, which are more infectious and many argue more deadly as well, are also responsible for this recent spike. Now, government officials haven't confirmed that, so it's not their official line at the moment, but certainly that is the theory from some doctors as well.
Has the vaccine campaign picked up at all?
Well, that's an interesting one. At the beginning of the year, India rolled out its vaccination program. Front of the queue for the vaccinations were frontline workers, not just healthcare workers, but sanitation workers and that kind of thing. Now, uptake was quite low at the beginning. It was way below what officials had hoped for. There's a huge amount of vaccine hesitancy here in India. I know you have it as well in the US. Now, what we're seeing, of course, is that as cases rise now, the government is trying to dramatically ramp up its vaccination program. And so only last week, at the end of last week, I was at a vaccination center at a public hospital in Delhi as the government opened up and widened its eligibility for the coronavirus vaccine. So now anyone over the age of 45 can get a vaccine, although some people are saying they should lower that even more and just get on with vaccinating as many people as possible. Now, last I checked, I think something like 80 million people have now had one dose of a coronavirus vaccine in India. Now, that might sound like a lot of people, but this is a population of 1.3 billion people, as you know. And the government set a target to try and get 300 million people done by July. And at this current rate, health experts say they're just not going to make that.
That's the BBC's Rajini Vaidyanathan reporting from Delhi. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
Stocks in the U.S. started the day with a climb after news on Friday that the U.S. economy added 916,000 jobs in March. It's the biggest boost since last summer, but there are still about 8 million fewer jobs than before the pandemic. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So among those job gains in March, weekly unemployment claims have also been falling. Do you see this as a sign that the economy is sort of on the road to recovery?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the acceleration in vaccinations and we have improvement in weather, the lifting of local restrictions, it's creating a bit of a surge in hiring for some of the hardest hit sectors like restaurants, bars, and accommodations, but also for other sectors, saw some really good gains in construction, manufacturing, education, healthcare. So I think this will continue. I think that the coming months should see further improvement in the labor market.
What about the unemployment rate, Jill? Because it fell to 6% last month. Do you think that that number paints a true picture of where jobs are in the U.S. right now?
You know, we've always had a hard time with this headline number because the way that we calculate this unemployment rate, it tallies up the number of people who are actively looking for a job and maybe not getting that job. Well, a lot of people are not actively looking. They're on the sidelines. They've taken themselves out of the labor market. In fact, the labor force is 2.2 million smaller than it was a year ago. And so until we get more of those workers back into the labor force, it's hard to see what the real unemployment rate is.
So what advice do you have for job seekers, those that are out sort of waiting this out? If you've been unemployed for a while, what should you think about before getting back out there?
I think that we always start with research because, you know, I'm a wonky weirdo and you got to figure out which sectors are doing well. But I think you also may want to assess some of the strengths that you have you might not realize are really valuable. When I talk to hiring experts and certainly CEOs and even smaller companies, they're saying, we know the technical skills aspect. We know when someone has an educational attainment, but what we're really focusing on are these soft skills. The ability to communicate, to empathize, to work with others, to solve problems. You know, one CEO said to me, I run a software company, but I actually need salespeople. I said, well, why don't you go hire a bartender? Because they seem to have great sales skills and they can relate. So you never know where that skill can take you.
Let me ask you about this figure I saw today. 4 million new businesses have been started since the pandemic began. 4 million seems extraordinary during a pandemic.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's great news, actually, because entrepreneurialism is certainly alive and well. This is a 40% increase from the prior year. And I think a lot of people are saying, I don't want to be at the whim, at the will of an employer. Maybe I ought to start that new business. Life is short. Let me get going right now.
About 30 seconds, Jill. If you're thinking about starting your own business, what should you consider?
Well, you know what? Don't forget, you have to figure out your health insurance, your life, your disability, your retirement plan options. And of course, you're paying both sides of the payroll tax, the employer and the employee. Factor that all in. Maybe you just want to keep this side hustle on the side while you still have a job. So that's something to really consider as you move forward.
Always great advice. That's Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp is pushing back against Major League Baseball's decision to move the All-Star Game out of Atlanta. The league is protesting the state's new law restricting ballot access. Here's Governor Kemp over the weekend.
Georgians and all Americans should know what this decision means. It means cancel culture and partisan activists are coming for your business. They're coming for your game or event in your hometown. And they're coming to cancel everything from sports to how you make a living.
Under Georgia's new law, voters will have less time to request absentee ballots. There's a ban on handing out food and water with 150 feet of a polling place. And there are new ID requirements for mail-in ballots, which were widely used in 2020. The law has split wide open the bitter dispute over voting rights. And in part two of our series, The Fight Over Voting, we wanted to hear from an election administrator navigating these issues elsewhere. Kim Wyman is Washington's Secretary of State. She is a Republican who supports mail-in voting, but also has concerns about changes to voting laws that Democrats are trying to make. Secretary Wyman, welcome back to Here and Now.
It's great to be on. Thank you.
And you're a Republican Secretary of State, as I said, in the blue state of Washington. So I want to know what your perspective first is on Georgia. Do you think Georgia lawmakers went too far with that law?
Well, I will be honest. I have not looked at all of the elements of the law, but, I think that the law that was passed in Georgia really has just been hyper-politicized on both sides, I imagine, and we're not even having a conversation anymore about the content of the law. We're really talking in the terms that politicos always talk about in election law about, you know, voter suppression and voter fraud, and the two parties kind of go to their two corners, and they don't listen to each other. And I think on that national stage, that's a lot of what we're seeing is a lot of hyperbole and not necessarily a lot of discussion about how we can make our elections better.
Well, why don't we talk about one of those provisions then? The one that prohibits giving food or water to a person waiting in line to vote. Do you think, from your perspective, that that solves a problem?
I guess the question becomes, what is the problem that you're trying to solve? And when I talked to some of my colleagues in Georgia and asked sort of why this was an issue, what they talked about was people that were, you know, kind of working the lines in voting centers and polling places were also wearing, you know, political, you know, ephemera or shirts or whatever. And so it was more of an issue of electioneering. So again, I think, what's the problem you're trying to solve? If you're trying to make sure people aren't electioneering, you know, is there another way to get there? And I'm not sure that conversation ever happened.
Right. And I don't know the laws in Georgia necessarily, but I would presume that electioneering is already illegal. You could just outlaw that.
Well, yeah, and I think that what we're seeing in state houses across the country is that when one party gets in control, and it can be the Democratic Party, it can be the Republican Party, and they start focusing on election laws, I think the easy path to take is to just talk to the people in your party and the supporters of your party's, you know, goals and objectives, and to write legislation really kind of in that bubble. And that's, I think, what we're seeing at the national level in Congress. What I'd like to see is both sides sit down and kind of hash through the issues that they have and the problems they're trying to fix, and have election administrators at the table to talk about what's you know, what's administrable, what can we actually do that's going to make elections better and get to the solutions that they're looking for.
To your point that both parties are passing laws, that is true. Look at Democrats in Congress. They're trying to pass a national bill that would standardize voter registration and mail-in voting, among many other things. Do you support the bill at the federal level?
As the bill is currently written, I do not. The biggest problem, first and foremost, is it's an 800-page bill that is very prescriptive in what election officials can and cannot do. The law is requiring us to test these systems to new standards by, I believe, January of 2022. And if your system can't meet the standards by that deadline, it will be decertified. So the problem is the testing labs don't even have a way to test the systems right now as we sit here today, 10 months before that timeline begins. And so effectively, this could decertify every tabulation system in the country. That's a problem.
I hear you. It sounds like a logistical problem, though. If the Congress were able to come to a compromise and say, all right, let's push this back 2 years or three, would you support it in theory?
Well, this is the bottom line here is there are so many elements of the bill that are like that. That's what we need to work through. And local and state election officials across the country are ready right now to have those conversations with Congress and really work through those elements, those specific prescriptive things that they want to codify in federal law and work through them so that they are something that we could work within and could administer an election under and make sure that counties and local jurisdictions could be successful in an election. So it's not just one part of the bill. It is systemic throughout the bill because it's such a large bill and is so prescriptive in, you know, the type of paper and the way we print an envelope to send an absentee ballot.
Now, there are some things that Democrats want to do that I think you're already doing in Washington state, so I want to ask you about that, including establishing automatic voter registration systems that would pull information from government databases unless somebody decides to opt out. How does that system work in Washington? Is it successful?
Absolutely. You know, I think that's one of the interesting places to be is here in Washington. We've already implemented almost every element of HR 1 into election law, and automatic registration is one of those examples. Anyone who gets what we call an enhanced driver's license, which is a real ID, these are people who have proven citizenship at the time of application. Those people are automatically registered to vote, and we do that at driver's licensing and at our health benefits exchange as well. So this has worked very well. It's been in effect for 2 years now, and we were able to build a system that could accommodate that, and it's working.
So why not make it national, or should we?
Because you need time and money. So if Congress wants to enact this at a national level, then states and local election offices need to have the resources to be able to build similar systems. You know, Washington has been a vote-by-mail state for almost a decade now, and it still took us about 5 years to get to that point once the legislation allowed us to move to vote-by-mail. So very similar threads with HR 1. And I'm not aware that Congress has funded all of these mandates that they've put into HR 1. You know, let's face it, states across the country are doing some really innovative things to expand the franchise for voters. I think that HR 1, the way it's written right now, really will stifle that because you won't be able to really have any kind of creativity at the local level to solve problems. Mm-hmm.
Well, you say that, and I have to point out that some people see that creativity in some states as doing the exact opposite, as actually making access to voting more complicated and more challenging. But one of the things I'm also hearing you say is that when this conversation becomes as politicized as it has over the past couple of months, that you're sort of missing the point. But isn't it kind of built into the problem partisanship? Look at your position. Respectfully, Secretary of State, we have to say you're a Republican as well. Mm-hmm. And it's the same in other states where Democrats are in charge of the vote. The whole thing is built in.
Absolutely. And that I agree with you. That's part of the problem. In fact, you know, I introduced legislation this session to make my office nonpartisan. And of course, immediately that got attacked as being a partisan move because they were accusing me of hiding, trying to hide what my partisan stripes were. And I just thought, wow, you know, I've been a Republican elected official for 20 years. I don't think I'm hiding anything. But, you know, the bigger point is this office needs to be above politics, and the decisions made by the chief election officers need to be in the best interest of the entire state that they represent, not just their political party. And that's going to take time. And I think the more we can make some of this administrative focus, the more we're going to move forward.
Kim Wyman is the Secretary of State in Washington State, and she is a Republican. Ms. Wyman, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Today, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky announced that more than 106 million people in the U.S. have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. That is nearly a third of the country. But as more people get vaccinated, there is still a significant chunk of the population deciding against it. And people like Alex Berenson are not helping the situation. He's a former New York Times reporter who has taken to Twitter and Fox News to fuel the fire of misinformation regarding the virus and vaccines. Derek Thompson, a staff writer for The Atlantic, has dubbed Berenson, quote, the pandemic's wrongest man. And Derek joins us now from Washington, as he does every Monday. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So we should start by stating the truth that the CDC says all three approved vaccines here in the U.S. are safe, effective, and reduce your risk of severe illness from the virus. But then there are these voices out there spreading misinformation. Why is Berenson particularly dangerous?
I just want to double down on building this truth sandwich here. It's often said among people who study information networks that the way to combat a conspiracy theory is to say the truth and then say the false claim and then repeat the truth again. So, as you said, the truth is absolutely that these vaccines are sensationally effective at blocking severe illness and death. Berenson's claims that they are, in fact, dangerous, that they can get people sick, even make people's immune systems vulnerable so that they can actually ironically get COVID, they're all wrong. And his claims are particularly dangerous because he has a large following on Twitter, about 200,000 followers on Twitter, and he seems to have a standing invitation on Fox News primetime shows like Tucker Carlson's. So it's really important, I think, that we not only, you know, not allow him to spread these claims uncritically examined on shows like this, but also point out for people that might have a family member or a friend who sees some of his information to be empowered to remind them that, as I did, checked every single reference that he gave me about his claims, and every single reference came back false, false, false. It's so important to tell people that he is spreading misinformation and not spookily true things about these vaccines.
So he actually blames the vaccine for a rise in cases, using Israel as an example, which in reality is actually doing quite a phenomenal job of vaccinating its population. How is he drawing this conclusion, and what's the truth?
When I asked him to give me a reference for this particular conclusion that Israel isn't doing a good job with the vaccines, he sent me an article in Hebrew. Now, I'm a Reformed Jew who does not speak Hebrew, like I suppose so many American Reformed Jews. I sent it to someone I know on Twitter who's a biologist in Israel who came back and told me that the article in Hebrew wasn't saying anything that Berenson said it was saying. So this was pure misdirection. Here's the truth about Israel. Israel is one of the world's leaders in distributing this vaccine to its citizens, and its daily cases have declined about 96 to 97% since January 17th. Its economy is nearly opened up. It's exactly what just about every American should hope we will also get from our vaccine experience, which is a massive decline in cases coinciding with a normalization of life. If we are lucky, and I think we will get there, we will be exactly where Israel is right now.
Another false claim widely circulated by Berenson, who says that the vaccine suppresses the immune system and can even cause death, that somehow the side effects are worse than the symptoms of the virus. No evidence of that, Derek. What are scientists telling you about this claim?
Well, this one was particularly strange. So he claimed that he found a study that showed that the white blood cell count declined after people took the vaccines. I pass this along to an immunologist in California, Shane Crotty, that I've been corresponding with for several months. He said, that the white blood cell count after people take a successful vaccine is supposed to decline. This is exactly what's supposed to happen. The white blood cells aren't disappearing. They're not being hurt. They're just leaving the blood, going to the site of inflammation, and they return to the blood in a few days. So essentially, Berenson was saying that the proper functioning of our immune system was something to be afraid of. Once again, pretty much complete nonsense. And this is exactly why I think it's difficult for some people who, you know, don't have an immunologist on call, like I'm very lucky to be able to confront these claims. They're a little esoteric. They seem technical. They sometimes use scientific jargon. But in just about every single case, he is 100% wrong.
So give us some truth-telling about this last one. Berenson is also peddling widely this idea that healthy people under the age of 70 should not be vaccinated. Again, no evidence of that, Derek. Where did he get that information? And tell us how the data disproves it.
Well, the data is really clear. About 100,000 people under the age of 65 have died of COVID-19. Meanwhile, of about 160 million vaccines that have been administered in the U.S. so far, a CDC review of clinical information has found no evidence that they've caused any deaths. So the current score in the competition between non-senior pandemic deaths, right, deaths under people 65 years or over, versus conclusive vaccine deaths is 100,000 to zero. Mm. I think that might be the most important statistic here. People should absolutely take these vaccines. They will help us reach the end of this pandemic.
Derek Thompson, always helping us understand what is truth. Staff writer at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston is in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.